There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1039, April 15th, 2024, Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say, machismo is all peaches and herb. Max will hang him high in Shanghai. Spaghetti culture coming to Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We shall explain gladly with gelato. Back to Il Padrino of podcasting.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Fernando and Aston Martin tie the knot till death do us part. Carlos is the logical choice for Toto. But there's pressure from the third party. Williams regret being nice guys after checking pocketbook balance. And this week's big reminder, of course, ladies and gentlemen, that you and I are very important, and we do need your contributions to keep this program up on the cloud. So please click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you want to, NAS. A slow weekend, a little bit of NASCAR. How you doing?
I am doing very good, sir. Thank you. I am actually excited because I am, as we speak, on the left coast. So let me say greetings and racing regards from Santa Cruz. This weekend, we are headed to the Peterson Museum in L.A., and the Long Beach Grand Prix with my friend, whom you have met, Mr. King James. And in La La Land, we are really looking forward to meeting F1 Weekly familiar members Tech Talk Tim and Eric Fernandez. And a few years ago, I was here. I was supposed to go there, but on the eve of the driving, I had food poisoning and I had to cancel that trip. So hopefully we will make it up this time. But the big news from last week, which you mentioned, not surprisingly, at the top of the show. Nando feeling peaches and herb, reunited and feel so good. Are you happy about this, sir?
Sure. It squelches all the fan dreams of him going to Red Bull or replacing Lewis Hamilton at Mercedes that might not be very competitive. So for me, this is the correct decision. It makes sense, and I love this. Two foes who reunite. We get the reunification of the GP2 engine.
Yes, between him and Honda still, now no more, still got the blues. So this is good. And you know, as they say, you meet the nicest and funniest people on Honda. Machismo extending his contract with Aston Martin, I think is very, very good for him, for motor racing, for Honda, for Aston Martin. Not good for one person, and that would be Lance Stroll. But that's another story. Machismo will have one more serving of sushi and tempura. Let's hope he keeps his temper in check, because after all these years, a championship after championship winning engine package is coming his way. Where he is, Mr. Stroll's secret agent man. They've given him number one status. As daddy's, my boy Lollipop is losing flavor race by race, which shouldn't surprise anybody. This is a very good decision, like you said, sir, but it was not a surprise given the options available to the driver holding a sign by the side of the track saying, half talent will drive for peanuts. Not many people have approached him. Timing of the announcement was a surprise so early in the season, but this is becoming more and more common. Honda and Alonso, they are no strangers in the night. What a turn of events it will be, if Fernando Alonso gets his long-awaited and much-deserved third championship with Honda Power. The slings and arrows launched from the Spanish Armada at Suzuka will be forgotten and forgiven. I think Honda will have a competitive package, if not the all-conquering powerhouse they are right now. And let's not kid ourselves, a large part of Max's success, apart from his immense talent, is from the mind of Adrian Newey. And Mr. Rogers, you're the first to know and realize I am a huge fan of Fernando Alonso. Oink, oink! But I am excited, El Grande size, because my three wishes these days are that in our lifetime we see championship number 3 for Alonso, championship number 8 for LCH, championship number 9 for Max. They are very capable of making this happen, if they have tools of the trade. But as Alonso has said himself, 19 drivers already know they will not be world champion this year, and most likely it will be the same case in 2025. As we all know, sometimes the best laid plans go sideways. I am wondering what will happen if history repeats itself. Honda and Machismo are reunited, and for whatever reason the Honda power unit is not competitive. Then the circus goes to the Japanese Grand Prix at Suzuka. Machismo is led by a Haas, and we hear on the team radio, GP3 engine, ah! This is what it sounds like when doves cry. Are you crying tears of joy on your hombre getting his hands on Honda engine one more time?
Of course I am. I love Fernando. Without the oink, mine is sincere and honest. And what's really hilarious is people forget that Lewis Hamilton was dominating with Mercedes from 2014 while there were other customers with Mercedes motors, that particular motor, and those customer teams did not win. Only Mercedes won. So unfortunately, you could be very correct. As Honda is put in the back, Adrian Newey just looking in the window wondering if they could come up with a good package. All this is going to be for fun and it's going to be exciting. But if Adrian Newey is not with Fernando, it could be GP3 engine. Ah!
Speaking of being sincere, it reminds me of Dan Gurney telling me what Colin Chapman said to him once. Always be sincere, even if you don't mean it. So we move forward now to Showdown and Lowdown in Shanghai. The dust and cherry blossoms have settled on the 2024 Japanese Grand Prix. Winners are winning. Turncoats are looking for new colors, and we all know who they are. And is more than one, and some are sucking emu eggs. This weekend we have the Chinese Grand Prix for the first time since 2019, when Bottas was on pole, that long ago. And Shanghai is the track where Sebastian Vettel gave Red Bull their first Grand Prix win, I believe in 2009. There has never been a racing track in real life or sim that Max did not like and perform well. He is looking for his first win in Chinatown, and I'm sure he would have won if we were racing there last few years. The competition is catching up. Colli was extremely close at Suzuka, but I think Max will pour hot sauce on the aspirations of 19 drivers after the first three laps of the Chinese Grand Prix. Mercedes in the modern era also took their first win in Shanghai in 2012, courtesy of Keke's kid Nico Rosberg. But the way things are going for Silver Arrows these days, they might as well relax by the Yellow River on Nando's copyrighted beach chair and enjoy some Peking duck soup. I am sure when Lewis and George open their fortune cookie upon arrival in Shanghai, it will say, you know when. Do you think there is hope for anybody to win this race apart from Max?
Well, maybe Bottas has good memories, could pull something out for steak, because, boy, their steak looks done. I don't know. You know, it's been so long since we've raced here. I certainly hope they've dusted the place, because FP1 is going to be very messy. My bet is Logan Sargeant crashes on FP1.
Well, I think with Audi buying Sauber, Bottas' career is at stake. But we will see what happens in 2026. So you're very high on your fellow American, Mr. Logan Sargeant.
You know what's really hilarious is I even heard Damon Hill trying to give him advice, saying, don't try to be Max Verstappen. I mean, those two names together never came to my mind, so I give it to Damon Hill for being super creative.
Indeed. Okay, Sainz winning in Shanghai. Now that will be a real pleasant surprise. Second win of the season for Carlito will be very cool. Prancing Horse won the very first Chinese Grand Prix in 2004 with the two-legged Rubinho. They have not won since 2013 with Omri, who wanted somebody else's car as his birthday present. Signor Luca di Montezemolo made his wish come true and said, have your cake and eat it too. And who can it be now? The one and only Fernando Alonso. No matter what we do, no matter what we cover, somehow he's always in the conversation. We must love him very much at F1 Weekly. Correct, sir?
He's in the world's conversation. We're just a little tiny part.
Yeah, very true, very true. We're just another brick in the wall. Okay, sir, Formula One, as we all know, is all about adding value. Since Alpine, Haas, and Williams are not adding any value at this time, let's hope they add points to their total, which currently have lots of zeros. I mean, their total is beginning to challenge the F1 weekly paycheck, which is impressive. What say you, amigo? Are you expecting any surprise, or do you think Max will hang him high in Shanghai, as I think?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be Carlito, maybe a little LCH if he's feeling good and he's in a good mood. But I think he's going to be pouting and having dreams of marinara. And yes, I mean, Williams is going to be a mess. Not only that, but they can't go flat out. And you know what's really ironic? Is if you remember 2019 when we were last in Shanghai?
See?
The person that crashed in FP1 was your friend, Albon.
Well, you know, he does not have the package to make things happen. And I know a lot of people are going gaga over him, and I wish him and everybody all the best. But, you know, he's not racing against Max or a recharge George Russell. He's racing against your buddy from Boca Raton. And we all know what happened when he was teammate to Max. Okay, I do know. Still have that image of Lewis Hamilton spinning him out and causing Albon not to have his first podium. But you know who was ahead leading that race. So that's the point of reference for every driver these days. Hopes are high, obviously, to derail Max's gravy train. There's talk on street and the paddock that Ferrari will catch up to Red Bull with the upgrades coming soon. I think, and something I've said many times, catching up to Max is one thing, passing him is another baton march. I still say the likes of Carlito and Charles will need a car half a second faster than the Red Bull to keep Max behind till the checkered flag is waved. Now, I have a feeling the way things are, competition is catching up, mainly Ferrari, that we may have more than one win for Scuderia Ferrari this year. If Carlos Sainz Jr. is going to have more than one win, then it's only a matter of time that Charles Leclerc will grab a win or two also. But I am seriously, seriously doubting that anybody will be world champion other than Max. But I've seen big leads blown away in Formula One also, so you never know. Do you have any hope for a sort of a surprise world champion this year apart from Fernando Alonso?
None whatsoever. I just want to count how many times Logan Sargeant crashes, and I want the camera on Vol's checking account.
Yeah, you know, I read a headline which I did not go into details, which was just before start of the recording here, that Williams are now seriously considering replacing him. And I will not be surprised that if Kimi Antonelli gets the seat so Toto can prepare him for Lewis Hamilton's replacement. And I think that I'll be surprised if Daniel Ricciardo stays in F1 till the end of the season.
I concur.
Okay, sir. Would you like to talk more about Formula One, or shall we move on to IndyCar racing?
Well, I am scared about Formula One and where it's going. And I think it's going to affect the people that are in it right now. And The description of from Adrian Newey on the 2026 rules and how they're frantically having to change things because in the simulator, it's pretty wild. So, and like Max said, keep it simple. The simpler, the better. But of course, they're going to make it super complicated and it's going to become unattractive to hipsters like you and I, Nasser.
We're hipsters of the 60s, not 21st century.
That's very, very true. And like I said, when I was reading the RPMs to keep up the generator that Adrian Newey was talking about, it made perfect sense for some really crazy, weird-sounding racing that's not very Formula One-esque. I think Adrian Newey should be designing the 2026 car, not the clowns and funny people at the FIA.
Well, you know, it's the speciness going on. They should just go back to V10 screaming engines and maybe allow turbocharged. None of this MCH, MHU, DFC, whatever they have there. We don't need extra weight. We want racing cars to go fast, sound fast. And as Max says, just keep it simple, stupid. But, you know, all we can do is bitch and moan. Nobody's listening to the little people, Mr. Rogers.
That's why I threw my microphone away.
That's good. Okay, sir, now we go to Prema to the Brickyard, IndyCar News. Italian Prema team, previously known as Prema Power Team, started in 1983 with Formula Renault. Today it is the big kahuna in all forms of European Junior Formula. The team was started by Angelo Rosen and is run today by his son Rene, and we interviewed Rene a few years ago. Prema alumni include Jacques Villeneuve, and the talent of all talents, Lance Stroll. The first Italian team at the Brickyard was Maserati, winning the Indy 500 in 1939 and 1940 with Wilbur Shaw. Ferrari also appeared at the Brickyard in 1952 with Alberto Ascari when the 500 was part of Formula One Championship. He would go on to be world champion at the end of the season. But his race at Indy did not last too many laps. I think he retired on lap 40, if I'm not mistaken. Sir, do you have any plans? I know you have never been to the Indy 500. Do you have any plans to go to the Indy 500 next month?
No, none. Zippo, nada.
Okay, I would highly recommend someday if you get a chance to do this thing, the speed at which these cars are traveling coming into turn 4, going through the straight. I mean, it's very, very impressive. You owe it to yourself. And I would, if I was you, I would keep an eye on the Greyhound.com. You know, sometimes they have deal. $99 return from San Jose to Hoosier State. That just might be your ticket.
That's a good idea, Nass. I'm right now, I'm just waiting for the bionic implants in my body. So once I get those, I could just run over there.
Oh, you can hop like a kangaroo.
Exactly. Thank you. With the sound effects, you know, when you hop with the bionic system, you have to have the boing, boing, boing.
Yes, that would be very impressive.
Gracias.
The boing heard across the world. Mr. Rogers coming to Brickyard.
Thank you, Nasser. And on that note, while we're jumping, why don't we take a quick break, and we'll be back after these brief messages.
Hi, I'm Elio Castroneves, four-time Indy 500 champion. And you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Clark, this conversation took place last Saturday in beautiful Black Hawk, California with Harden Ganley. And what a story this is. He left his native country, New Zealand. He raced it a little bit with only $50. And he was telling me about his journey, you know. He went on a ship through Suez Canal, landed in Lisbon, took a bus to London. And he had one thing on his mind, to become a Formula One racing driver. And he was a mechanic. He worked for McLaren. He was crew chief to Peter Revson, did some Formula 3 in England, then made it to Formula 1. And then he also started a car company, Tiga Racing Cars. You'll probably remember with Tim Shenkin. And his wife, unfortunately, passed away last year, Judy, and she was quite a known figure in motor racing also. She used to drive race cars also, and I think it was the 1970 Sebring, she was first in her class in an all-female crew. Very impressive. And then she was very well known in the timing and scoring arena of Formula One circuit. So I went to his house. I would like to thank him very much for inviting me. And we sat down and just talked nothing but motor racing. And I hope our listeners enjoy this conversation. And thank you again, sir.
Okay, I'm here in beautiful Black Hawk with a gentleman from New Zealand, Mr. Howden Ganley. Mr. Ganley, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. I probably should be out playing golf, but as you can see, it's raining like crazy, so I'm not going out.
Okay, let me take you back in time to your native country, a place called Ardmore, 1955. You were there as a teenager. Please tell us what you remember from that day, and was that the race that sparked your interest in motor racing?
Yeah, definitely. I didn't really have any interest up to that point. I was interested in sailing. We lived on the edge of a lake in Hamilton, and I sailed most weekends all through summer. But I guess we were off at the beach house. My father was going to Ardmore, and my brother was going, and so I thought, well, I'll just tag along and see what it looks like. When those Grand Prix cars came around the corner for the first time, I was just flipped my life. Yeah, it was just so fantastic, I thought. By the end of the day, I said, oh, forget the sailing. I'm going to be a Grand Prix driver.
Now, in that race, do you remember anything? Were there some drivers who made it to Formula One?
Well, there had been in Formula One because Prince Bira in the 250F, he won the race. And, of course, that made me a 250F Maserati fan straight away because I thought it was the most beautiful car. Tony Gaze was there in a Ferrari, and Peter Whitehead was also in a Ferrari. Jack Brabham at that stage hadn't come to Grand Prix, but he was driving a Cooper Bristol pretty energetically. He's one who certainly did. That would be the standout one, of course, three-time world champion, and he hadn't even been to Europe at that stage.
Now, in those days, how would you follow Formula One racing living so far away from Europe?
Well, my father subscribed to Motorsport magazine, so, of course, after that I started looking at his magazines. I mean, they had that beautiful colour, that supplement, photographic supplement in the centre. And so I learned about Fangio and everybody. But I think the New Zealand newspapers, once the New Zealand Grand Prix had started in 1954, then they took much more of an interest in motor racing. So you got the race reports, pretty brief ones, but there was a lot in the newspapers about it.
Did you have any racing heroes growing up once the racing bug got to you? And any particular race or driver that stands out while you were a teenager?
Well, Stirling Moss became my instant hero, I guess, because of 1955, and then he just signed with Mercedes, and then I started reading about him, and he was of an age that I could identify with, perhaps more than some of the older guys like Fangio, although, of course, I recognise that Fangio was the absolute master. And while I was at school then, I wrote to Stirling, and I got an autograph photograph from him, which I still have. So, yeah, I followed his career, and then I was given Stirling Moss's book of motorsport, which came out in 1955, and I must have read it about 100 times in that first year. So, yeah, he would be my first hero in motor racing, and it's so lovely now to know him.
How long was your career as a motorsport journalist, and how much fun was interviewing racing drivers?
Well, my journalistic career at that stage was extremely short because I left school, I guess, when I was 16, and I got a job in the local newspaper. Of course, all I wanted to do was write about motor racing. But I only worked there for 2 years, and I was, as well as writing stuff for the newspaper, I was submitting articles to, in fact, I had, before I left school, been submitting articles to various magazines. And then when I came to England and worked as a mechanic, I continued to send stories back to magazines in Australia and New Zealand. So I suppose you could say I had a 4 or 5 year career as a motor racing journalist, and I'm just trying to start it up again.
Did you interview any of the famous drivers of your time?
I was much too shy to interview anybody. No, I didn't.
Okay. You talk about England in 1961. You were sailing there loaded with $50, from what I understand. Please tell us about this journey and what kind of dreams were you harboring at this stage of your life?
Well, I had by that stage done some racing in New Zealand on an absolute shoestring, and it was actually 1962 that I set off for England. After the season finished, 61-62 season finished, I set off for England on an old ship. I arrived there just before Easter 1962 to go to Goodwood, and unfortunately that's where my hero Stirling had his accident.
Your initial foray into motor racing was through preparing cars for others. How important is the interaction between the crew and the driver in setting up a car?
Oh, well, it's absolutely vital. I was, actually, I should go back on the previous question and say, yeah, I was coming to England to be a Grand Prix driver. In fact, I only had $50, was a slight deterrent, but oh, just another hurdle, really. Yeah, I was very fortunate that eventually, in order to make some money, had to become a mechanic, and I learned an awful lot. And so it made me appreciate just how important it is that the driver gets on with the engineer or can communicate with the engineer, and then the mechanics say very supportive of the driver and want to do a lot for him. And I became that way when I was a mechanic. I was totally supportive of what I considered my driver. Our driver, Peter Revson and Chris Amon, would be the two classic examples, I guess. Guys that I mechanic for and thought got on well with and really wanted to do everything I could to make their car better.
Talking of Chris Amon, he's also from New Zealand. Are you in touch with him?
Yes, I had lunch with him about 3 weeks ago.
Does he ever come to the US?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Okay, but he's doing well.
Oh, he's very well, yeah. He seems pretty fit and, yeah, I think he's enjoying life.
Okay. Would you agree that what some say now, that driver played a bigger role in winning than the machine in the early days, 60s and 70s?
Well, certainly the engineers have become much more important in recent years because of all the telemetry and everything, and they can see what the car is doing. They don't have to solely rely on what the driver is telling him. If we go back into previous years, say even in my era, all that could happen was that you had to come in and tell the engineer or the chief mechanic, more often than not, or the designer, what you thought the car was doing. And if you were wrong, then you were sending him off in the wrong direction. Now, of course, the telemetry enables the engineers to see what's really happening.
Bruce McLaren, also from New Zealand, a name synonymous with motor racing. When was the first time you met him?
Oh, I'd met him when I was racing in New Zealand in 1961, I guess it would be. So, yeah, I already knew him when I came to England. But I didn't immediately go and work for him. I messed around and did other things and tried to get into racing by other methods. Then things had all sort of come to a bit of a halt. And one day he called me up and offered me a job because he was going to expand his team.
How was he as a person? We know about him as a race car driver and an excellent engineer. Anything you can tell us that most racing fans would not know about Bruce? Something positive, of course.
Oh, he was just one of the nicest guys that you could ever meet. Yeah, I mean, he had a great sense of humor. He was a terrific leader of men. I think everybody who worked for him just would do absolutely anything for Bruce. And Bruce used to come into the workshop in the morning and he'd go around and say good morning to everybody and look at what you were doing. And he really lifted everybody. You couldn't find a nicer guy, really.
Do you remember where you were and how you got the news when he was killed?
People always talk about, I remember what I was doing, where I was when John Kennedy was shot. I remember absolutely vividly where I was and what I was doing when I got the phone call about Bruce. We had actually planned to go testing with the former 5000 car that day because, you know, he put me into the works car. But I was back at my own workshop from where I ran my gearbox business, and the phone rang and it was Barry Newman telling me the news. I just couldn't take it in.
Are you still in touch with members of his family?
Yes, I see Amanda, his daughter, every so often. I see his wife, Patty, from time to time. And having just been in New Zealand, I've seen his sister, Jan, as well.
Everybody doing well?
They all seem pretty good, far as I can see.
You mentioned Peter Revson. You were his crew chief, I believe, in 1966. How would you rate him as a driver?
Oh, I certainly thought that he was going to go a long way. I'd seen him, I had actually met him when he was over in Europe doing Formula One in his first go at it with Tim Parnell. Yeah, then when I came to work for him, I could see, I thought he would certainly get to Formula One. He had that ability. He was going to get there. But, of course, it took him quite a lot longer from 1966, I think, until, end of 71. He had his first drive with Tyrrell, if I'm right, and then went to McLaren's in 72.
Given his profession and connection to cosmetic company, was he really a ladies' man as per the reputation?
Well, I was only his mechanic, so I don't know, but he sure was a good-looking guy. How much money he had was another matter, I don't know. But, yeah, for sure, he must have been able to attract some very good-looking ladies.
Yeah, that's what I hear all the time. 1967, you were driving a Brabham BT21 in British Formula 3. Were you the driver, entrant, and sponsor?
Yes. I had, through working for McLaren's and then being seconded to Ford and then working for Peter Revson, I'd finally saved up enough money to buy a brand new BT21, I didn't have a lot of extra money once I'd bought all the equipment, and I had to keep going to Europe where I could get starting money and prize money. And then I'd come back, when I had gathered a little bit of that, I could come back to England and do a British Formula 3 race, because you didn't get any starting money or no worthwhile prize money in those. And then I'd go back to Europe and earn a bit more money there, and then I'd come back to England and do it. That's why I didn't do a great number of British Formula 3 races.
Going from preparing cars to driving them, what was the biggest surprise or challenge for you?
Well, of course, I'd started racing a long time before in my mother's Morris Minor. Big challenge is really just being fast enough. I always imagined that I would be able to do it. Of course, these things always look easy when you're watching over the fence. So it was just a gradual evolution, and I don't think anything ever surprised me greatly.
Now, talking about speed, when somebody gets into motor racing, the speed you have is the speed you keep, or a driver can learn how to go fast.
Yeah, I think you can learn to go fast. Perhaps Graham Hill is one of the world's greatest examples. You become accustomed to speed. Well, it's a bit like people you see on the highway. They get used to going down the highway at 70 miles an hour. When all the traffic comes to a halt, they don't realize how much it's slowed down. And you get that way in racing. You at Le Mans, for example, I always said that you go down the Mulsanne straight. In those days when I raced, they didn't have any chicanes. After a while, it seems so slow, you think you could get out and walk alongside the car, because everything becomes slow motion for you.
Who were some of the drivers you raced against in Formula 3?
Ronnie Peterson, Rainer Vassell, Francois Sever, Tim Shanken, they would be, or Emerson Fittipaldi, the guys that all came into Formula 1 at about the same time in 1970-71.
Did you race against Jochen Rindt also?
Well, yes, I did. I guess I did a couple of Formula 2 races in 1970, and I had actually been in a Formula Junior race in 1963 at Nürburgring, which is the first time I think a lot of us became aware of Jochen. I crashed in practice and broke his nose. Yeah, so I knew of him, and then when he turned up at Crystal Palace that time and beat everybody, I actually knew who he was.
You know, the reason I asked is I started following Formula 1 in 73, and he was deceased by then, and I used to read a lot about him. And even when you read his widow Nina's like remembrance of him, she says, you know, he was a difficult man to get along. A lot of journalists call him arrogant. Did you get to know him, and how did you find him as a person?
Well, I knew him a bit because I had... for one race mechanicked at Winkelmann Racing, and Alan and Jochen were good friends, and I used to be around the Winkelmann workshop a bit, and Jochen was in and out of there, so I got to know him there. And in fact, at the end of 1969, he asked to see me and discuss whether I would, if I went to Team Lotus for Formula 3, then he said I'd probably finish up in his Formula 2 team. So yes, I don't think I knew him very well, but I knew him enough as a friend to talk to.
He was okay to deal with as far as you are concerned?
Well, he was, yeah, I can understand why people might think that Jochen was awkward. He had a manner about him, but I think underneath he was fine. But I was dealing with him or meeting with him in a different relationship. I wasn't his team owner, so it was a much easier friendship, if you like.
In those days, drivers were not only competitors, but also good friends. Rindt and Stewart, a good example. Did you develop personal friendship with some of your drivers, including Formula 3 and Formula 1?
Well, Tim Shanken and I became quite good friends. We met in 67 when we were both doing 1,000cc Formula 3. And we just seemed to get on well with each other, and eventually we bought a house together, and our careers followed very similar paths. And then later on, of course, we started Tiger Race Cars, racing cars. But at the same time, I became quite good friends with Rainer Vassell, because he spoke good English. I didn't speak any Swedish till later when I had a Swedish girlfriend. And then Ronnie Peterson a little bit, but Ronnie was a little bit shy. I became sort of friends with Francois, really, when we drove together at Le Mans for Matra. I don't think I ever became particular friends with Emerson. I mean, I knew him and say hello to him and all the rest of it, friendly enough. But, yeah, Tim was probably the outstanding one.
How was Sever, a real good-looking guy like Revson? How was he to deal with?
Oh, Francois was a wonderful guy, yeah. He was so intelligent, great sense of humor again. Yeah, we got on well together. So it was devastating when he had his accident at Watkins Glen. That really not me, for quite a bit, for six. But yeah, you could see why Francois could attract the ladies. He had everything going for him.
And how was my man, Ronnie? I was a huge Ronnie Peterson fan. How was he as a person?
Oh, well, Ronnie was very laid back. He was two different guys, Ronnie. You know, he was sort of just Mr. Average, friendly, laid-back guy out of the car. And when he got in the car, he had all that wonderful car control and balance. And he was fantastic.
Of the drivers you raced throughout your career, who were the drivers you thought were really good, especially guys who did not end up winning world championship? Because a lot of time, good drivers don't get the right breaks.
Well, the outstanding example for me was Chris Amon. That, as I saw it, he was the one guy at that time, possibly plus Dan Gurney, but Chris could go head-to-head with Jim Clark and beat him. Then somehow, amazingly, it just didn't go right, but he was outstanding. And, of course, of the others, you will think, wow, these guys are all pretty good. They're hard to beat.
1970, driving a privately entered McLaren M10, you were second in the British Formula 5000 Championship with 10 podium finishes. What was the highlight of the season for you, and were you frustrated that you did not win a race?
Well, yes, you probably read that I didn't win a race, but that's not true. I won at Alton Park. And I did win one of the heats at Castle Coombe. I don't know why it's gone down in history as I didn't ever win one of the championship rounds. Well, that was a big break for me because Bruce McLaren gave me a Formula One test at the end of 69. And after the test, he said, right, I'm going to put you into Formula One in a year's time, but I want you to do a season of Formula 5000 racing. And so it was effectively a works car, but the running costs were provided by Bruce's next-door neighbour, Barry Newman. Yeah, what did we do? We did 18 races. I think we finished 16 and were never lower than fourth. It was the European Championship, actually, not the British Championship. And I suppose the highlight, setting the new lap record at Castle Coombe, which stood for goodness knows how long, many, many years, and in that dice with Peter Gethin, pole position at Andersdorp, and the way we did it, we just go out, do a warm-up lap, and do a time, and then come and sit. But I suppose in the end, winning at the 5000 part of the Gold Cup was the most memorable, because then I got to ride around on the victory lap on the wagon with John Surtees, who'd won the Formula One section. And of course, I was very shy, and then sort of tugging my forelock and saying, "Oh, hello, Mr. Surtees." But later on, as I've come to know John, I think he's a great bloke as well.
You mentioned Anderstorp in Sweden. You know, I took a trip there last September because I wanted to see Ronnie's home track. I've never seen so many trees in my life. How did you find the place and the track back in those days?
I mean, how do we physically find it?
No, in terms of, did you like the track? I mean, out in the boonies?
I liked the track. I went there first, one of the first ever races they held there in Formula 3 in 1968, and then I went back in 69 in Formula 3, and then 1970 in Formula 5000. And I discovered that if you really attacked those corners, they had slightly banked corners,
yeah. You
could get a good time. So, it was a track that suited me.
You were second at Monza, and I hope I have this information correct. How special is that place for a driver, and what was it like without the chicanes?
Well, when I went there in Formula 5000, which I guess is what you're referring to, second place, yeah, and we were sort of walking wounded at the end, but I didn't find it terribly interesting because you just drone down those long straights. When we went back there the following year in Formula 1, and then there was the multi-car dices, then that was really pretty exciting, a lot more enjoyable. You just drove the thing as hard as it would go, whereas in Formula 5000, you always try to nurse the engine along because of the heat, and the Chevy engine used to overheat, and then it would crack the cylinder heads. So you had to be careful. You weren't going flat out.
You finally arrived in Formula 1 in 1971, 10 years after sailing from New Zealand. Please tell us some behind-the-scene wheeling and dealing that brought you to the house of PRM.
Well, yeah, having had the second place in the Formula 5000 Championship, didn't seem like a good idea to go any further. And BRM were having a bit of a driver shuffle. I very nearly went to March, but apparently Bruce McLaren had mentioned me to Louis Stanley, and Barry Newman was a good old entrepreneur. So he talked to Louis Stanley about me, and I actually went there really as the number four driver just to see how I went. John Miles was taken on. Then John and I were to do the non-championship races, so I was going to be really a bit of a dog's body at the end. But fortunately, then I had a couple of good races, and all of a sudden I was the number three driver. And, of course, they were running three cars full-time.
Now, Louis Stanley was quite a character. Somebody said of him recently in a magazine, actually in Motorsport, that he thought he was Enzo Ferrari of England. And Niki Lauda also had a few things to say about him. How did you find him as a person and team owner?
Yeah, I think did I say he was the Enzo Ferrari of Britain? That was something that I've always thought. BRM were really the Ferrari of Great Britain, that they were the ones who made their own engines, gearboxes, everything, and so they were a fully-fledged constructor. Louis Stanley was a bit of a mixed bag. He was not the easiest guy to drive for, and you could go in and out of favour. I was never quite sure why. And so eventually I decided I couldn't stay there any longer, and after 2 years I then moved on. Whereas he'd offered me a very good drive for 73, but I thought, no, I need to change teams here. So we parted probably not on the best of terms. But then when I had my accident in 74, he was just fantastic. He got both myself and Mike Hailwood out of the Krankenhaus in Germany, and got us flown back to England and got us into St. Thomas's and got the best man, Mr. Urquhart, who had looked after John Surtees and Stirling when they had their accidents. And he was looking after us. And really, Big Lou couldn't have done more for us. He was just terrific.
Good to hear that. Now, it was around this time you met a Stanford-educated racer and a lady who became your wife, and sadly, Judy passed away last April. Will you please share with us some remembrance of her and where you first met her?
In 1971, I had a call from Patty McLaren telling me that she had this very good friend coming over to stay with her for a while, and they were going to come to the races because Patty was still the team owner or whatever portion of the team she owned then. She said, I really want you to meet her. And I wasn't that interested because I figured I was well equipped with girlfriends. So eventually, Patty kept chasing me up. And at the Spanish Grand Prix, I went up to the McLaren compound and I met this lady. But that was it. We just met. And then I came to Riverside at the end of that season to drive the Can-Am car, BRM Can-Am car. And this very nice lady came up and started talking to me. And I realized it was the same lady from Barcelona. Anyway, a night or so later, with a bit of prompting from Jackie Oliver and his wife, then wife Lynn, I took Judy out to dinner. And our relationship just developed from there. And I'm just so lucky that I married her eventually. I mean, it took a little while, a few humps and bumps, but we were married in 1975. So we're married nearly 32 years, and I could never have found a better wife. She was words kind of fail me, really. She was so fantastic. She was so talented. She could do absolutely everything. She was just a beautiful human being.
I've seen her in videos of, especially at Monaco Grand Prix, working the stopwatch. She was quite an expert on timing and scoring, right?
She was she could do absolutely anything. She had a very high IQ. She was a member of Mensa, you know, for those high IQ people. And she could time a huge number of cars on one watch, and she could do a lap chart. And I've seen her at least twice do the whole of the Mont 24 hour, never get off the stand, sit there and do a lap chart. And now what concentration does that take? And so, yeah, she was a great timekeeper and a great lap charter. And I reckon her lap charter, the 73 Canadian Grand Prix, is the right one.
Yeah, that's coming up in my next questions. 1971 Italian Grand Prix. I was talking to a friend of mine last year, I think, and he asked me a question. He said, of all the races run in the history of motor racing, Grand Prix motor racing, if you could go back in time, what race would you want to be at? And I said, instantly, Monza 71, and you were in that race. Tell us about that event, please.
Well, yeah, I qualified on the second row. According to several watches, I had a time that was much quicker, which would have put me on pole, and I was complaining to Tim Parnell when the times came out. I said, get up there and sort that out, Tim, because you got all the times and the other team had it. Anyway, he said, no, chap, you'll be all right. Anyway, and he turned, that was good advice, because when I thought the chap had been holding the flag up for long enough, I just dropped the clutch. As I was going through between the two guys on the front row, which was X and Eamon, I thought, oh dear, I've jump the start by too much, I'll be penalised. And at that moment, Clay Regazzoni came past me from the fourth row. So I figured, well, I'm dead safe now, because if they can't get me without getting Clay, and they're not going to penalise Clay. So then off we went, and, you know, we were slipstreaming away. Unfortunately, my engine deteriorated somewhat. I kept trying to keep it as cool as possible, but I don't know what was going wrong with it. So I was clinging onto the back there. Then I lost the rear brakes and nearly had a couple of accidents. So that was a bit frustrating. And at the end, I thought, well, these guys, the other four, because the pace got slower and slower and slower, and I could see this BRM coming up behind, and I thought it was Joe Siffert. And I'd fallen out of the leading bunch at one point earlier on in the race, and Joe came along and towed me back up to them. So I thought, well, I there's no way I can win because my engine's basically gone here. So what I should do is try and drag Joe up into the leading group because, you know, he's catching up. He's obviously, his engine's okay. He'd had a bit of a gearbox problem earlier on. So I dropped as far back off the group, the other four, as I could go. So to give a tow, because, you know, you can tow from 200 yards back. And so I helped to drag this BRM. I was somewhat surprised when the BRM arrived and it wasn't Joe, it was Peter Gethin. But, so, you know, all I'd done is sort of cost myself. The pace had kept up, I guess I'd have been at least fourth. By dragging Peter up, I pushed myself back down a place, which is a pity, but whatever. So, yeah, I thought they would all run into each other at the last corner. So I was on the power way early, and they were bouncing off each other, but then they just accelerated me.
Yeah, I was reading, this was Peter Gethin's first and only win, and some years ago I was reading his interview, and he said, you know, it was so close that intentionally he raised his hand before the checkered flag. So, you know, this being Italy, he thought they'll think, you know, this guy won. Was that the most exciting race you were ever in?
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial, with the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir, and we shall start with MotoGP from Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas. Maverick Vinales was the winner for Aprilia. Fellow Spaniard Pedro Costa was second, with Italian Enea Bastianini third man on the podium. Did you watch this race by any chance, Mr. Rogers?
No, I did not. I was too busy gardening and working under the beautiful skies of California.
Yes, sir. I am also moving around, so I did not watch, but I did watch the highlights on YouTube. The Cota track is very beautiful. I really like this track. So the championship leader is another Spanish rider, Jorge Martin, on 80 points. Bastianini is second with 59 points, and Vinales third with 56 points. And I think we mentioned last week that Liberty Media has also purchased the commercial rights for MotoGP, and there is talk, especially from LCH, and I agree with him, that a doubleheader with Formula One and MotoGP, especially in Texas, would be fantastic. What say you?
Well, there could be problems as well. Those are two kind of audiences, because there's a big, big turnout for MotoGP, and then there's a big turnout for Formula One. Can you actually combine that? And what would you call that turnout? Mega? Huge? Or it could be like the British and the Italians in a soccer match, and then the bar fight begins.
No, they will call it the Texas-sized crowd, and it can be done. But what the good news for Liberty Media is, they can jack up the prices even more.
And we haven't even gotten to Vegas yet.
Exactly, but I think Vegas prices will come down from the stratosphere where they were last year, because there was a huge drop in 3-4 days before the race day. So, but we will see how it works out. Okay, next round of MotoGP is at the end of this month at Jerez de la Frontera. Dr. Miguel and I were at this track many moons ago. Actually, it was the first Formula One preseason test with the hybrid technology, hybrid engines, and I will never forget how disappointed I was in the sound of those engines. And at the airport, this really made up for it. At the airport, we had a brief but interesting chit-chat with Charlie Whiting. He was also leaving, and Jerez Airport is now JFK, so it was easy to talk to him. And the track is very nice. And, you know, they had a fantastic duel between Senna and Mansell in 86. And for that, I will always remember this track. Okay, sir, Formula E from Misano Adriatico. They were exciting the Italians past weekend. Winners were Oliver Rowland in race one for Nissan. And Oliver Rowland is a very good talent, much better than quite a few who have been in and out of Formula One in late years. But his crime was he was not related to the Strolls or Latifis of the world. Race 2 winner was one-time F1 racer and one of our favorites, Pascal Wehrlein for Porsche. Michael Andretti's driver Jake Dennis was second, and next round is at the end of this month in Monaco. And, sir, good news on Kovi, Heikki Kovalainen. He had his heart surgery, and he's now recovering at home in Finlandia. So we wish him full and speedy recovery. Would you have a message for Formula One's one-hit wonder?
Absolutely. Get well soon, buddy. Don't worry. This is the most important race of your life.
Exactly. And, you know, he comes from a town called Suomussalmi or something like that. And it is on the northern fringes of Finlandia. And you can imagine how cold it gets. Okay, sir. Now we have some sad news. And I was very disappointed to hear this information because of where it happened. And this is regarding a rider named Pat Hennin. Now, as we all know, United States have produced and made a big impact in the world of MotoGP. From Kenny Roberts of Modesto, California, to our favorite Kentucky kid, Nicky Hayden. Steve Baker from Bellingham, Washington, started the championship-winning tradition in 1977 on a Yamaha for the US of A. Then came King Kenny, winning the world championship in 1980, also with Yamaha. From 1983 to 1993, this was the decade of American dominance. In between, the only non-American world champion was Australian Wayne Gardner in 1987. And listen to this, Mr. Rogers. Freddie Spencer from Louisiana took the title in 1983 and 1985 with Fernando Alonso's favorite manufacturer, Honda. Eddie Lawson from L.A., SoCal, was the world champion four times, in 1984, 86, and 88 with Yamaha, and in 1989 on a Honda. Then Wayne Rainey, who now lives within like stone throw away from Laguna Seca, he went three in a row with Yamaha between 1990 and 1992. Then in 1993, Kevin Schwantz won on a Suzuki. Next American MotoGP champion was Kenny Roberts Jr. They used to call him KRJR in 2000 on a Suzuki. The last American champion for Honda was our favorite Nicky Hayden. And I am very pleased to say I saw him win his first MotoGP race on home soil at Laguna Seca. Now this brings us to the very first American rider, Pat Hennin, to win in MotoGP level competition. He sadly passed away in California on April 6. He was 70 years old. Pat grew up in Northern California. His day of days in international competition came in the 1976 Finnish Grand Prix at Imatra, when he became the first American rider to win in the premier 500cc class. Now, just like Pedro Rodriguez winning the 1967 Mexican Grand Prix and organizers not having the Mexican national anthem, same thing happened in Finlandia. At Kyalami, they played Mexican Hat Dance for Pedro winning. And I wondered if they played I Feel Good by Brother James Brown for Pat. Pat also won the 1977 British Motorcycle Grand Prix at Silverstone, on both occasions riding for Suzuki. His racing career was cut short by a serious accident and head injury at the 1978 Isle of Man TT race. At the time of his death, it's reported that he was living in San Mateo, which is right up the road on Highway 101 from the Palatial Studios in San Jose. Our condolences to Pat Hennin, family and friend. And sir, the reason I'm sad that I wish I knew he was in this area. And then San Mateo, how far is San Mateo from where you are right now? 20 miles? Yeah, we could have gone and spoken to him. And because I do appreciate people who get outside their box or their own zip code and try new things far away from the comfort of home life. You know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about, Nasser.
Yeah. So, once again, our condolences to family of Pat Hennin on his passing. Okay, sir. Famous. Before we go into famous last words, anything you want to say about the upcoming Long Beach Grand Prix or the Chinese Grand Prix or your favorite Lunesca?
Well, the Long Beach Grand Prix will be interesting. There'll be a lot of vintage racing. I believe there could be Formula 5000. You might even get Indy, vintage Indy, some Panos, some carts. So it should be very, very fun. And of course, the crowd is going to be awesome, Nasser. You'll get a lot of photographs and you'll have a really good time.
Yes, sir. The plan is this. My friend and I were going to drive. He's working on Friday. So after late Friday afternoon, we're going to drive down to SoCal. And Saturday, we are planning to go to the Peterson Museum. And I've never been there, so I definitely want to go there. And then we'll go to the race, Long Beach Grand Prix, on Sunday. And this is something Jimmy and I and a couple of our other friends, and back in the day, we used to drive every year and have a good time. I sent, apparently Zac Brown will be there. So I sent a contact to, you know, Zac Brown is involved with IndyCars, Formula One, has United Autosports. So I sent an email to our contact in England, and she said that he's not racing there through United Autosports, but she will forward my message and request to their IndyCar operation. And she was very kind enough to say that if for some reason does not work out, let me know, because, you know, I will be at the Monaco Historics and I'm sure Mr. Brown will be there. So we'll try to hook up with him. And I also reach out. One good thing is Romain Grosjean is now driving for Juncos Racing, Ricardo Juncos, this guy from Argentina who owns a team here, and IndyCar Racing. And his PR lady, who is also from Argentina by the name of Amira, she has been very cooperative, and she said that I will try my best to get you a slot, 10-minute with Romain Grosjean, which may or may not happen. But, you know, a lot of things are also happening in the background, and that will lead to bigger and better things for us down the road, and we're talking about down the road this season. So we will give update as and when things are confirmed. Shall we move on to famous last words now, sir? Yes, sir. The plan is this. My friend and I were going to drive. He's working on Friday. So after late Friday afternoon, we're going to drive down to SoCal. And Saturday, we are planning to go to the Peterson Museum. And I've never been there, so I definitely want to go there. And then we'll go to the race, Long Beach Grand Prix, on Sunday. And this is something Jimmy and I and a couple of our other friends, and back in the day, we used to drive every year and have a good time. I sent, apparently Zac Brown will be there. So I sent a contact to, you know, Zac Brown is involved with IndyCars, Formula One, has United Autosports. So I sent an email to our contact in England, and she said that he's not racing there through United Autosports, but she will forward my message and request to their IndyCar operation. And she was very kind enough to say that if for some reason does not work out, let me know, because, you know, I will be at the Monaco Historics and I'm sure Mr. Brown will be there. So we'll try to hook up with him. And I also reach out. One good thing is Romain Grosjean is now driving for Juncos Racing, Ricardo Juncos, this guy from Argentina who owns a team here, and IndyCar Racing. And his PR lady, who is also from Argentina by the name of Amira, she has been very cooperative, and she said that I will try my best to get you a slot, 10-minute with Romain Grosjean, which may or may not happen. But, you know, a lot of things are also happening in the background, and that will lead to bigger and better things for us down the road. And we're talking about down the road this season. So we will give update as and when things are confirmed. Shall we move on to famous last words now, sir?
I need some last words now, sir.
Okay, today they come from Suzuka after the race. Now, Carlos Sainz has done 3 of the 4 races this year, and he has been on the podium in 3 of them. Of course, won the Australian Grand Prix. And this thing about, is Ferrari keeping the wrong Charles or Chuck, is a big question being asked of Frederick Vasseur. So he basically was asked about, did they jump the gun in hiring Lewis Hamilton and letting Carlos Sainz Jr. go? And this is Frederick Vasseur's answer, which I like very much, and I quote, "We have the same question each weekend. Do a copy-paste of my reply of last week. Next one." End quote. The answer reminds me of a show on ESPN, In Your Face. Sometimes you just have to fight fire with fire. That's all for this week. Till we meet next week behind palatial walls. A blazing goodbye and ta-ta.
Good night.